On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we're talking about how browsers are actually pushing back on certificate authorities, and they're actually forcing shorter default expiration dates on TLS certs. Talk about how that can affect your organization. Plus, have you ever wondered about maybe swapping roles? Well, what if a security engineer swapped with a software engineer? How do you think that'll go? Well, Curtis will take us through that journey. Plus, lots of organizations are digitally transforming, and they're moving to remote workforce, and they got to secure the remote workforce. And so we have a great guest, Nidhi Srivastava. She's the global head of enterprise agility practice at Tata Consulting Services, and she's going to take us through it. Shouldn't miss it. It's Wyatt on the set. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Securing every access point in your company doesn't have to be a challenge. LastPass unifies access and authentication, making securing your employees simple and secure, even when they're working remotely. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 405, recorded August 7th, 2020. How agile is your business? This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Get the best well-rounded IT education from the experts. Visit itpro.tv/enterprise for an additional 30% off all consumer subscriptions for the lifetime of your active subscription. Use code ENTERPRISE30 at checkout. And by Thinks Canary. Detect attackers on your network while avoiding irritating false alarms. Get the alerts that matter. For 10% off and a 60-day money-back guarantee, go to canary.tools/twit. Enter the code TWIT in the How to Hear About Us box. And by Worldwide Technology. Worldwide Technology's Advanced Technology Center is like no other testing and research lab, with more than $500 million of equipment, including OEMs like NetApp. And it's virtual, so you can access it 24/7. To learn more and get insights into all that it offers, go to wwt.com/twit. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise. But I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their fields, starting with our very own geek in paradise and the storm watcher, tracker, dodger, Mr. Brian Chi. How are you doing, sir? How are you doing, sir, down there in the state of Hawaii?
Me and Kurt both dodged storms. It was great.
I know. That's true. How are you doing?
I'm melting. It's hot and humid. And trying to clean up a lab is lots of work, lots of sweaty work. But anyway, I have Diamond Head in the background. Again, compliments of the Honolulu Drone Club.
Beautiful, beautiful. You're always making me jealous of all the scenes down there. Fantastic, though. Cool. Well, speaking of experts, we have our favorite security and enterprise journalist on the show as well, Mr. Curtis Franklin. He's a senior editor over there at Dark Reading. Curtis, it's always great to see you, my friend. How is the great state of Hawaii? Are you dodging tropical storms down there as well?
Well, we dodged the storm last weekend, but this weekend it's looking good. And surprisingly enough, I'm in virtual Las Vegas as we speak. I've been covering Black Hat. Today I'm switching over to DEF CON, and boy, the action is hot and heavy. It's actually been fascinating seeing the way that people are able to interact online using a variety of different methods. It actually makes me feel good. You know, I think the last few months have really helped everyone up their online collaboration game, and you're seeing that here in the conferences. So while everyone misses the face-to-face contact, there's still a lot of great stuff going on, including something I'm looking forward to, the Capture the Satellite contest that the Air Force is sponsoring that I'm looking forward to covering tomorrow.
Very cool. Well, like you said, Black Hat's been a pretty big topic of the week. So we have some content and research that we've actually seen show up there in a lot of our content today. So that will definitely show up. But do you host services or sites? Well, if you do, you're probably familiar with TLS or SSL certs and expiration. Well, browsers are starting to push back against certificate authorities, and they're trying to shorten the default expiration date of those certificates. Now, what do you think? Is that going to cause problems? Will that affect your sites and customers? Well, we will definitely talk about that. Now, have you ever thought about maybe swapping roles in the current role? Well, what if a security engineer and a software engineer actually swapped roles? How do you think that'll actually go? Well, Kurt will take us through the journey there. Plus, lots of organizations and processes are actually trying to move to digital transformation, right? They want to secure their remote workers. And we have a great guest, Nidhi Srivastava, Global Head of Enterprise Agility Practice at Tata Consulting Services, to take us through all of that later on in the show. But first, it's been a pretty big, busy week in the enterprise. So let's go ahead and jump into this week's blips. Now, in the enterprise today, it wouldn't be a week without a leak. Now, this time it's one of our favorite chip makers, Intel, classified and confidential documents from the U.S. chip maker allegedly resulting from a breach have been uploaded to a public file sharing service. Now, the cache of secret information is 20 gigabytes large and comes from an unknown source. It was announced as the first part in a series of Intel leaks, according to Tilly Kotman, a developer and reverse engineer who received the documents from an anonymous hacker. Now, most of the information is supposed to be protected intellectual property. Now, the developer was told that the information was stolen from Intel in a breach this past year. Now, some of the info even had references to source code, which had comments mentioning things like backdoors. Now, that could mean anything out of context, but it doesn't look good to have this type of information leaked in any capacity. Now, the repository contains data, proprietary code, including dozens of companies like GE Appliances, Microsoft, Qualcomm, Motorola, AMD, and Lenovo. And some of the files in the archive include technical specifications and relate to internal chipset designs, including Kaby Lake platforms and Intel Management Engine ME. Now, this initial release also contains documents related to a ton of other things. There's a whole list here, but some things like the Intel ME, Kaby Lake, the BIOS reference code, sample code, initialization code, a bunch of other things, of course, and they're exported into these Git repos with full history. So there's a lot there. Now, how did the hacker breach Intel? Well, according to them, they found an Intel server on a CDN that was not properly secure, and that weakest link, of course. And this particular machine was seemingly selected based on details collected from an internet-wide scan. Now, they used a custom Python script. The hacker claims they were able to test for default username access and unsecured access to files and folders. According to the hacker, access to the folders was possible if you knew the right names, and they needed to guess just not one, but a couple others. And once in, they were able to back into the root directory and get access to any other directories in the system. Now, this release has already been dubbed juicy by Kotman, believing future leaks from their source are likely to contain even juicier classified documents. I, for one, am hoping that in the coming months, we don't see hackers squeeze any more secrets at Intel.
Well, researchers have created a new framework to evaluate user security awareness. Researchers at Israel's Ben-Gurion University have developed a framework for continuously evaluating the resilience of end users to phishing and similar social engineering attacks. Unlike other security awareness evaluation techniques that rely heavily on questionnaires and the self-reported behavior of users, the new approach is based on actual data gathering from end user smartphones, PCs, network traffic to and from devices, and attack simulations. In a presentation at Black Hat, Ron Bitten, principal research manager at Ben-Gurion University's Cybersecurity Research Center, said that current approaches don't distinguish between different attack types or platforms and are largely static in nature. In the new framework, the researchers explored numerous social engineering case studies and identified the human vulnerabilities and technologies that adversaries tend to exploit in social engineering attacks, and the countermeasures that can then be used to protect against such exploitation. The BGU researchers developed two sensors for profiling user behavior. One was an endpoint agent that collected multiple sensor data from the device, including installed apps, app permissions, app source, ranking, mail activity, security settings, and social network activity. The researchers also developed a less intrusive network-based monitor that inspected traffic from and to the end-user device using various methods, including deep packet inspection and assessment of app-level protocols. As a result of testing the framework, researchers found that security awareness scores derived from objective measures such as data collected from endpoint and network-based solutions are highly correlated to user success in mitigating social engineering attacks.
Our friends at Amazon are investing $10 billion to compete against SpaceX in satellite broadband. Amazon has received U.S. approval to launch 3,236 low Earth orbit satellites for its planned Project Kuiper broadband service. A Federal Communications Commission order granting Amazon's application was released this last Thursday. Amazon said in a blog post it will invest more than $10 billion in the project. Quote, this investment will create jobs and infrastructure around the United States, build and scale our ground network, accelerate satellite testing and manufacturing, and let us deliver an affordable customer terminal that will make fast, reliable broadband accessible to communities around the world, according to Amazon. Amazon will target areas without good internet service and said that Project Kuiper will deliver high-speed, low-latency broadband service to places beyond the reach of traditional fiber or wireless networks. The planned satellites would orbit at altitudes of 590 kilometers, 610 kilometers, and 630 kilometers, allowing latencies far lower than traditional satellite services that use geosynchronous orbits or more than 35,000 kilometers. This is similar to SpaceX Starlink, but SpaceX is much further along as it has launched about 540 satellites and is getting ready to start beta trials with customers. Well, gang, all these low Earth orbit mini satellites means we're looking potentially at the end of terrestrial astronomy. And it really makes me wonder if the science advisors in the White House are asleep at the wheel.
Now, also related to satellite, and right, this past week, there's been a lot of buzz around Black Hat, but one thing that caught my eye there was the call out about satellite internet communications. Now, we've talked a bunch about them on Twilight, especially Cheaper's last article there. According to Black Hat content, satellite internet communications are susceptible to eavesdropping and signal interception by a far-flung attacker located in different continents or countries from their victims. And all they need is $300 worth of off-the-shelf equipment to pull it off. Think about that. Now, the first thing to know is that the way that satellite communications work provides a wide global geographical attack area. When a satellite ISP makes an internet connection from a customer or for a customer, it beams that customer's signal up to a satellite in a geostationary orbit within a narrow communication channel. Now, that signal is then sent back to a terrestrial receiving hub and routed to the internet. However, when the response signals are sent back along the same path, just in reverse, the transmission downlink between the satellite and the user will be a broadcast transmission containing many customers' traffic simultaneously. Now, essentially what this means is that if they're actually able to perform an interception, adversaries could eavesdrop on vast sections of the globe and their traffic. Now, the common assumption is that for an attacker to pull off, this kind of signal interception takes a lot of money. However, in this case, all that's needed is a $200 to $300 PCIe satellite tuner card. That's it. Once the equipment is in hand, all they have to do is point their dish, scan for signals, and make a short recording of the feed they find. Now, depending on the signal-to-noise ratio, the amount of data captured could range from a megabyte to a terabyte. Now, once an internet connection is identified, it's possible to record it, parse the information, and also, there's actually a couple obstacles that go along with the process. According to research, the feed might be transmitted using two protocols, the MPEG video streaming format, or a newer protocol known as the generic stream encapsulation, GSE. Now, as a result, the team found ways to go around that. They are often losing big chunks of these types of internet feeds, resulting in corrupting files. But they have a fix, and they wrote a forensics tool called GC Extract that can reconstruct meaningful IP data of a corrupted GSE recording. Now, how can this affect you, maybe, if you're using satellite internet right now? Can they record stuff on me? Well, it means that anything you do, private or otherwise, can be recorded. Sounds bad, right? Well, to me, many internet satellite providers, including new ones like SpaceX, might need to do a complete audit on their comms to ensure that they aren't easily vulnerable as the ones found in this research.
Well, a new Windows print spooler zero day harkens back to Stuxnet. 10 years after the game-changing Stuxnet attack was first discovered, a Windows printer program it exploited has been found to contain additional dangerous zero-day flaws that could allow an attacker to gain a foothold in the network as a privileged user. The researchers who discovered the new flaws in Microsoft's ubiquitous Windows Print Spooler service say they wanted to see if there was still a way to game Print Spooler for a Stuxnet 2.0 style attack 10 years after the first known cyber weapon attack was unearthed. Tomer Barr, research team leader at SafeBreach, and his team found 3 zero-day vulnerabilities in the 20-year-old Windows Print Spooler program, which serves as the interface between a printer and the Windows operating system, loading the print driver, setting up print jobs, and printing. In a Black Hat presentation, the new post-Stuxnet vulnerability was said to include a memory corruption bug that could be used to wage a denial-of-service attack and 2 local privilege escalation bugs. While Stuxnet used a print spooler exploit to gain remote access, the local vulnerability found by Barr and his team could allow any user to gain the highest privileges on the machine, either as a malicious insider who has physical access to the machine or via an existing remote access foothold previously obtained by an attacker. Exploiting the flaws is fairly simple, too, say the researchers. They were able to employ PowerShell commands to exploit the vulnerabilities. Microsoft informed the researchers that it has no plans to patch the denial of service vulnerability, they say, but sometime after their Black Hat presentation, the researchers expect Microsoft to issue a new patch for the local escalation flaw. Until then, they say one way to mitigate these types of attacks is to establish a group policy setting that prohibits non-privileged users from accessing Windows Print Spooler from their machines.
Beware, oh, find my phone, Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, according to the NSA. The National Security Agency is recommending that some government workers and people generally concerned about privacy turn off Find My Phone, Wi-Fi, and Bluetooth whenever those services are not needed, as well as limit location data usage by apps. Quote, location data can be extremely valuable and must be protected, according to an advisory published on Tuesday. It can reveal details about the number of users in a location, user and supply movements, daily routines, user and organizational, and can expose otherwise unknown associations between users and locations. NSA officials acknowledge that geolocation functions are enabled by design and are essential to mobile communications. The officials also admit that the recommended safeguards are impractical for most users. Mapping, location tracking of lost or stolen phones, automatically connecting to Wi-Fi networks, and fitness trackers and apps are just a few things that require fine-grained locations to work at all. Okay. These recommendations are common sense, but I thought I'd do a reminder that if you're trying to stay off the grid, that you have a few more things to add to your checklist.
If you thought your organization would never be hit with ransomware, even maybe immune to it, you might want to think again. Now, even Canon thought that as well, and they're now victims of a recent ransomware campaign. Now, the consumer electronics giant has suffered a partial outage across its U.S. website and internal systems, reportedly, thanks to the Maze game. Now, the global camera maker has circulated a note to employees confirming that the ransomware is to blame for outages across its main U.S. website, email, collaboration platforms, and various internal systems. Now, the Maze ransomware gang has taken credit for the outage, claiming to have lifted 10 terabytes of data, private databases, and other data in the process. Now, this fits with the known modus operandi of the group, which usually threatens to leak or sell sensitive data in the targets if the targets don't pay the ransom. In fact, researchers said in April that the Maze gang has created a dedicated web page which lists the identities of their non-cooperative victims and regularly publishes samples of the stolen data for proof. So far, this includes details of dozens of companies, including law firms, medical service providers, and insurance companies that have not given in to their demands. Now, in this case, the Canon website was hit hard and it was down for a long period of time. And the large electronics vendor hit by ransomware situation is eerily similar to the recent attack on Garmin as well, which was the work of the Wasted Locker ransom and Evil Corp. In that case, the GPS specialist reported actually paid a multi-million dollar ransom to retrieve its files. Now, my forecast is this won't be the last of these we see here in 2020. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, we have a really great set of bites. But before we get to those, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is IT Pro TV. Now, you're a busy professional. I'm a busy professional. It can be difficult to learn new skills or develop skills to make a career change. Now, having been in the tech field for a long time, I can tell you, you need all forms of training when entering a new field. And IT Pro TV makes sure you will have what you need when learning IT. Now, their instructors make learning IT entertaining. IT Pro TV also provides you with virtual labs so you can have the ability to try out the skills you just learned. You won't have to purchase expensive hardware or deal with setup. Run your virtual machines with multiple instances of Windows Server and desktop clients on your OS X, Linux, iOS device, and of course your Windows platform. IT Pro TV gives you the opportunity to truly be ready for your IT certification test with their practice tests. Now get ready for exam questions covering Microsoft, CompTIA, EC Council, PMI, and many, many more. Now with IT Pro TV, you can also have the opportunity to supplement your education with webinars featuring hot topics in the tech world, as well as events and podcasts. Check out their podcast, Technado, with Don Pezzett. He's featuring industry guests and IT news recaps. IT Pro TV makes sure you have a well-rounded education that will set you up for success in your future IT career. With over 5,800 hours of IT training, IT Pro TV is the best place to go for getting started or expanding your IT career. Earn certificates in A+, CCNP, and so many more, including CompTIA. Now, IT Pro TV is the official video training partner for CompTIA and has 12 CompTIA on-demand courses. Take courses like networking skills or security skills, Linux, Apple, and more. Sign up for premium membership and let an expert guide you with setting goals and implementing an IT training program to help you reach them. And in August is IT Pro TV's DevOps Month. That's right. They'll have a free Python weekend where 5 Python courses will be available at no cost. Invest in yourself and your future with IT Pro TV. Get the IT training you need from the experts. Go to itpro.tv/enterprise and use code ENTERPRISE30 to receive 30% off all consumer subscriptions. That's itpro.tv/enterprise and use code ENTERPRISE30 for an additional 30% off for the lifetime of your active subscription. IT Pro TV, build or expand your IT career and enjoy the journey. And we thank IT Pro TV for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, now time for the bites. We have a good set of bites here today. Now, you know, CDN and website security has been a pretty constant challenge at different layers of the OSI model. And we've actually talked about this in the past. Now, we've actually heard that the browser companies have actually decided to shorten the lifespan for TLS certificates in a move to actually aid security by causing, but also possibly causing operational troubles. Now, on September 1st, browsers and devices from Apple, Google, and Mozilla will show errors for new TLS certificates with a lifespan longer than 398 days. Now, the move, while beneficial to security, pushes back against certificate authorities, or CAs, and may prove an operational headache for businesses. Now, the lifespan of SSL and TLS certificates has drastically shrunk in the past 10 years. In fact, just over a decade ago, the main register sold TLS certificates valid for 8 to 10 years. Now, the Certificate Authority Browser Forum, or CA Browser Forum, a group of CAs imposed a 5-year limit in 2011. This was then cut down to 3 years in 2015 and now 2 years in 2018. Now, for me, I've actually drive several services in CDNs and tell you this can actually affect your services. The change will actually have a bunch of consequences. In fact, Apple says connections to CLS servers violating its new requirements will fail, which may cause network and applications to actually fail with it and prevent websites from actually loading for people. Now, Google warns certificates older than 388 days will actually be rejected with an error and treated as misused. Ugh. Now, Apple recommends new certificates to be issued with a 97-day validity, and the browser makers have long argued that shorter TLS lifespans are better for browser security because they reduce the time in which attackers could compromise or duplicate that certificate, which is actually critical to protecting traffic and the website. Now, successful attack here would give someone basically the keys to the kingdom. And this is better than actually a username and password in a lot of ways, because credentials may grant access to a system that can enable lateral movement across the environment. But access to a certificate could let an attacker do far more nefarious activities, include controlling web properties, access desktops and laptops, or even encrypted communications. Now, there are challenges for organizations and content providers when it comes to these shorter times. These renewals can be done with automated tools. However, many businesses continue to do this manually. In fact, a lot of larger firms may be responsible for renewing thousands of certificates. Now, for administrators, it's an operational headache here. If they fail to keep up, visitors will, and their websites will, certain browsers will actually see a warning on the site that it isn't secure, which may actually be a big red flag, and you'll see some reduced traffic to them. Now, I want to bring in my co-host here because there's a lot of experience here, I think, in the whole group. Now, Curtis, I want to go to you first. Now, we're constantly hearing about organizations forgetting to renew things, causing their services to not respond to, like, let's say, CA revocations. This happens a lot in IoT. Will this just make it worse? Are we going to see this a lot more, basically?
Well, I think that what it's going to do, ideally, is push more organizations to automate their certificate renewal process. Because if you've got human beings involved in the renewal chain, then absolutely, I think we're going to see more of them. If the big piece of automation that you have is an item in reminders that says renew TLS cert today, there's a lot of room for error. So, like I said, I hope that this will push a lot of organizations, even smaller ones, to go ahead and automate the process so that they don't find out that their certificates have expired by hearing it from their customers.
Right. I think the interesting thing, and Hubert, I want to throw this to you because, in lots of different parts of the industry, short expiration dates have been used. Like, for instance, when you're talking about OAuth protocol, they have short expirations on their access tokens or even on their refresh tokens. So it does work. It does help for security. So is this just a good thing, and then applications and services should just comply, or is it just a way for the browsers to push the CAs in the other direction to say, hey, we kind of control this environment, you got to listen to us?
I think the answer is actually both. There is definitely a lot of work being done in the IEEE and IETF. One specifically, a bunch of my ex-students are on the committee for DNS Dane. Basically, it comes down to you have to be running secure DNS and all that good stuff. But instead of having a separate certificate authority, if you own the domain and you're the authority for the domain, you can actually embed the public keys or whatever into your DNS. And that gives you the ability to revoke your certificates faster. So basically, a certificate in the DNS Dane world, once you make the change, the certificate gets revoked across the globe as fast as DNS updates happen. So it needs to happen actually on both sides. We need the ability to revoke certificates quickly. A lot of these attacks that you hear about, a lot of them are based upon old credentials, old certificates, things like that. So the reality is both sides need to have a change. I personally think DNS Dane is actually a really good way of doing things. But, this whole bit about the browser pushing back, good job, guys.
It's about time. We start forcing standards and forcing more security. I definitely agree. Curtis, I want to throw the last one to you. I mentioned it just quickly, but this is going to have a huge effect on IoT devices, right? Because we're already seeing a bunch of problems with some devices out there, even some consumer devices like Roku devices and other applications of these types of things. So are we going to see even the consumer space have some problems if they shorten these even more?
I think we're likely to see that problem. And here's the interesting thing. Many of those IoT devices that will have problems don't have the ability to throw an error message. All they'll do is stop working. And once that happens, it could take a while before someone notices that a particular IoT device isn't working. Maybe it's a system that is supposed to alert on a problem condition, a water sensor in a flood control system, something that alerts on smoke or high levels of carbon dioxide or carbon monoxide, something like that. Those don't tend to report in every day. If you're a user, you only hear from them when there's a problem. So if there is a certificate failure, they don't fail safe. They fail deadly. And that's sort of the worst case scenario. It is going to be incumbent upon anyone who's acting as the service provider for one of these IoT devices to make sure that their certificates are kept up to date and to put in some sort of watchdog device that will ping it regularly and let them know that that certificate is still valid.
Right. You know, it's interesting. I mean, I was watching SpaceX recently, and they were saying, hey, there are applications that they're using in their vehicles are actually using similar to like Electron application, which is actually basically just a browser that connects to a site and downloads data. So this could affect a lot of different organizations and applications and services out there. I really hope that the browsers pushing for this model will actually force these services and these organizations to have some more automated processes to actually do better from a continuous deployment model perspective. So we'll hopefully see better automation there in the future. Well, that does it for that bite. Now, I can say that in my career, I've definitely done a swap or even a shadowing of a job, of a different job than I already have, whether it's support engineering or even an IT role or a data center role. But what I have never done is actually a security engineer. Now, what if a security engineer and a software engineer actually swapped roles? How do you think that would go? Well, Curtis, want to take us through that journey?
Well, in a presentation at Black Hat this week, we heard from a security engineer and an infrastructure engineer, both of them with Salesforce, who shared lessons that they learned from their professional role reversal and some advice that they had for people on each team. Now, this is not an entirely new concept. At large corporations, as part of their management training programs, it's very common for them to take people who are seen as high potential, people who are training to become executives, and run them through a wide variety of operational departments. That's fairly normal. What's less common is to have technical professionals who swap jobs. Now, as part of the job, Principal Security Engineer Craig Ingram was dropped into the Salesforce runtime team, and Principal Infrastructure Engineer Camille McKinnon joined the Platform Security Assessment team. One of the things that they gave as takeaways were the importance of planning and prioritization. You know, Ingram on the runtime team said that engineers spent much of their time looking at competing priorities and deciding what they were going to work on. That's in addition to the new features they had to develop and bug fixes to improve scalability and performance on the platform. Now, of course, the security team was also coming around asking for bug fixes. It was another thing entirely to live through this process, Craig said. Even though he said he thought he was pretty empathetic to the balance that engineers needed to have between the ongoing engineering work and projects from security and other interruptions. Ingram explained that this is how engineering teams scale. They break projects down into parts. Many of them use objectives and key results, or OKRs, to determine what needs to get done and define what the results should be. And it's a measurable way to ensure whether or not a project was successful. Ingram said, it's time for security engineers to learn the sort of ruthless prioritization that the operations people have to have as their day-to-day way of getting things done. Maybe implementing the latest tool you saw isn't as effective as implementing a supply chain security tool that can test for code changes in open source packages. Now, another helpful practice was the retrospective, which the runtime team did every week to review what they had completed or go over an incident that caused downtime or maybe a security problem. Retrospectives are blameless. They don't look at assigning blame. They look at what happened. And it's a safe time to have a comfortable conversation about what goes well, what's not going well, what a team wants to keep doing, and what they want to improve. Now, McKinnon emphasized the importance of listening to engineers and asking for user feedback. She said engineering teams rely on product managers and professional user researchers to do customer interviews and create products that suit their needs. And she says that security can do a lot of the same. Even if you have to say no in some cases, having an engineer who actually understands that you looked at their need, that you understand why they're trying to get there faster and have tried to work around the problems so that you can help them build something more secure, is going to go a long way towards making sure that the recommendations are likely to be followed. Start with small development, small changes. Start changing how you do things. Start using software engineering principles and changing how your team does planning. She also recommended that security teams do retrospectives. Look at what has gone well in the past week. Look at where the issues were, whether they involved a complete breach or not. If you work and act like the teams you're partnered with, she says, you're going to end up with a much better and more secure process for everyone. So, Lou, let me come to you first. What do you think about this idea of swapping jobs with someone on a different team? You know, in a case of someone like you in your day job, perhaps swapping with someone on the OS team or swapping with someone on a security team. Do you think there could be value in a swap like that?
Yeah, I definitely think a swap is, you know, you're kind of throwing a person in the deep end almost to go and experience the other person's career. And I think that can actually create a ton of empathy for the types of things they have to handle. Now, I haven't done a swap, but I have done a job shadow. In fact, I've even worked in the case of being an embedded engineer where I've actually embedded into another team, still maintained my role, but kind of shadowed what they did and understood, you know, the different things that they had to handle. Both inside the company and I've actually done with customers, so large organizations outside the company. And I can tell you that one thing, it gives you a completely different perspective on how things are handled there. And you actually do create a kind of a customer point of view slash partner point of view when you do other things. So when I'm developing software, I think, you know what? Like, I've been in a case where customers might use it in a particular way, which we never thought we're going to use it that way, because I've been in that situation. I actually got to live it. And so I kind of gain that empathy for making sure that we handle particular scenarios, use cases because of that. And so I can definitely see the advantage of doing this in cases like security, because in software engineering, you tend to do things, build software in a way, and you might not really necessarily understand all the different attack vectors or facets that somebody can go and take down your service or even remove data or take data from your service. And so being in the shoes of a security engineer and understanding and trying to figure out those different vectors can be really important. So I definitely think this is a great exercise. And I encourage a lot of organizations to do it because it definitely helps for not only point of view, but definitely from an empathy perspective.
You know, I love that idea of the empathy perspective. And that's something that I did a little research on long ago when I was in graduate school. You know, this is such an important thing that in the research and scientific world, they've created a whole new branch. It's called translational science. And this isn't translating into other languages, well, slightly, I suppose, because it's aimed at getting people in different disciplines of science to talk to one another at all. Brian, you spent the last couple of decades primarily in the scientific and research arenas. First of all, do you think that there could be value in having people from one department or one discipline spend time on teams from other disciplines or other departments? And B, do you think there's a snowball's chance in hell that they would agree to do it?
For the most part, I don't think so. So let's back up a little bit. My entire position at the university was originally designed by the head of admin of my college. they wanted me to go in as a generalist, one that, you know, knew communications, networks, systems, and things like that. So basically, I was a consultant. They wanted me to go in and go bopping around between the different research groups for the specific reason of creating an opportunity for cross-pollination of processes, data, thought, research, and things like that. It worked reasonably well, but sadly, the money wasn't there. Now, going a little further back, what I used to like doing as a project team or, you know, for the government was I would go and try purposely to swap people around. So it worked. The biggest one where it succeeded the best was actually on a program to update the PKI facilities for the FBI Leggett program. And the idea was I swapped my engineers around, my technicians and so forth, to try and make sure everybody tried out, took a test drive on someone else's job. And it was twofold. One, I wanted them to appreciate what each person did and to have a fresh set of eyes on how the process should or would work. But mostly, I also wanted to make sure that I had redundancy in my roles. I didn't want to have the ability, I didn't want to have someone so key to the organization, if they got hit by a Mack truck, my entire house of cards would fall down. So I used it as for redundancy within my staffing, but I also did it to make sure that there was some opportunity for the cross-pollination. So I really like this process. I've tried to do it as much as possible. Sadly, the number one reason why I wasn't able to do it on more projects is mostly because of managers that refused to let me pull this off.
Well, I think that that's interesting, talking about management resistance to something that came from a particular level of management. That's something we see far too often. And Lou, I'm going to turn back to you for the final question. You know, with things like Brian was talking about, the political issues, the management issues, do you see any downside to this kind of job swapping? Are there any drawbacks? Or is that going to be something that is specific to particular organizations depending on their politics and their culture?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there. I think it's definitely particular to particular organizations. But there could be drawbacks. Obviously, there could be some reversal where somebody goes and works in a particular role and thinks, this is easier than I thought, that you don't have to handle as much. Maybe it's in a particular week that's kind of quiet, or if it's a particular time frame or period that's quiet. And so that could actually have backblow, meaning that now you go back to your role and think, I that's an easy role. Maybe I should go do that role instead. Or, you know, so there definitely could be backblow. But again, from a politics perspective, you know, that's also very particular to different organizations and leadership and in those organizations. So, you know, there could be means where you go and work in a different role where the politics is just too strong, where you're not used to it. And it definitely has a negative context and a negative point of view from that perspective. And so, you know, there is, things could go wrong. But, you know, what I've seen is most of the time, these types of swapping, shadowing, that kind of thing, usually has a pretty positive effect, because it's you experiencing in a case study kind of way somebody else's shoes and understanding the complexity that goes along with it. And that usually has a pretty positive effect on people's point of views.
Well, this is one of those things. A lot of organizations are recognizing the value of cross-training across different disciplines. You know, the military is one. 40 years ago, if you wanted to rise through the ranks of a particular branch of service, having experience in a separate branch put an end to that. These days, it has swapped around so that if you want to be especially colonel or above in rank by the end of your career, you must have spent time working within another service in order to get that far. Here's hoping that more and more organizations are going to follow that lead. Well, we've got a lot more to come here on a great episode of TWIET. And to take us that next step for us, I'm going to turn it back over to Lou.
Thank you, Kurt. Of course, next up, we have a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Ride. I'm looking forward to that. But before we get to that, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Thinks Canary. Now, with everything that's going on in the world, Thinks Canary wants you to know they're here for you. Now, especially in the current climate, data breaches are on the rise, and companies usually find out too late that they've been compromised, and that's after spending millions on IT security. Now, Canary is designed to be installed, configured, and most likely forgotten in minutes. Now, if you do need to be alerted, Canary gives you the option of deciding how you'd like to be told, whether it's email or text message, right there on a console. You can actually use collab services like Slack using webhooks, syslog, or even their API. Now, alerts are dead simple, and they're easy to work with, conforming to your needs. And they shouldn't be the other way around. And Thinks Canary has made that possible. You won't be inundated with alerts because you get only the ones that matter. Now, two things all companies should know when it comes to data breaches. Hackers take the path of least resistance. Your staff, your endpoints. It takes an average of 191 days for a company to actually realize there's been a data breach. Now, you're probably wondering, how does the Canary work? How they can help you here? Well, here's how it works. They look identical to a router, a switch, a NAS, a server, a Linux box, or a Windows server, so attackers can't tell the difference. They're appliances that look identical to these things. Now, Thinks Canaries don't look vulnerable on your network. They look valuable, appealing. They look like the real thing. You can put fake files on them or enroll them in Active Directory, and when attackers investigate further, they give themselves away, and you're instantly notified. Now, the company behind Canary has been in the security game for almost 2 decades. They've trained companies, militaries, and governments how to break into networks and have used that knowledge to build Canary. Now, Thinks Canaries are deployed all over the world on 7 continents and are one of the best tools against data breaches. One of the best. Having tried this system out, it's amazing how simple it is to get started by quickly adding these things to your network. Do your organization a favor. Get some of these right now. Visit canary.tools/twit. For just $7,500 per year, you'll get 5 canaries, your own hosted console, upgrade, support, and maintenance. And if you use the code TWIT in the How Do You Hear About Us box, you'll get a 10% off the price for life. We know you'll love your Thinks Canary, but if you're not happy, you can always return your Canaries with their 2-month money-back guarantee for a full refund. That's canary.tools/twit, and enter the code TWIT in the How Do You Hear About Us box. And we thank Thinks Canary for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show where we actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Ride. And today, it's no exception. We have Nidhi Srivastava. She's the Global Head of Enterprise Agility Practice at TCS. Nidhi, thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate you being here.
Mm-hmm. My pleasure as well.
Now, our audience, they love to hear people's origin stories, their journey through tech. Can you maybe take us through your journey and what brought you to TCS?
I'm somewhat of a TCS lifer, if you will. I'm going to date myself. So I joined in December of 1991 in India. Worked for about 10 years in various tech roles. So I've done everything, dirtied my hands with coding, testing, program releases. And then I moved over to Chicago. And took up an account management position. So over the years, one of the things that I've really loved about TCS is that it has given me a chance to play many, many different roles. So I've played technical roles, business development roles, consulting roles. And the last few years I've been with the consulting practice. And you would have seen agility has become quite a rage in every which way, whether it's business agility or IT or technology agility. So I lead this practice that works with customers in building their enterprise transformation programs and embracing agile ways of working. And it's just been a really, really interesting journey at TCS, I would say. They have never let me get bored. That's all.
That's great. Well, I definitely can tell you TCS does a lot of things. In fact, I've worked with a lot of their engineers in the past on several projects where I work. Now, they're in a lot of facets of the market. Can you take us through the company and some of the recent focus areas TCS has?
Sure. So TCS is a very vibrant company. And because I've spent quite some time here, I've seen it evolve and emerge as a real powerhouse of IT consulting, digital business technology transformation. So that's what we do primarily. In the recent times, we are really focused on working with our customers and driving their growth and transformation agenda. Because if not anything, the current COVID pandemic forced all of us to live a digital future. So we have worked from home, we have studied from home, we have shopped from home, we've entertained ourselves from home, we've even done doctor's visits from home. So my whole point is that we see this tremendous opportunity to work with our clients and reimagine their digital journey. So that's really our current focus.
Yeah, that's interesting because I think you kind of hit the nail on the head. The remote workforce is becoming very prevalent. Obviously because of the whole pandemic, but also because a lot of organizations are moving to that global workspace. What are you seeing from an organization perspective? How are they struggling when it moves to the remote work and that remote workplace?
So if I may say so, it has been a huge surprise for my clients. And even I will say for a level within TCS that the way we all moved to adopting remote work, or what we in TCS like to call secure, borderless workspace operating model, it has been an amazing journey. I have met with several CIOs who have really been surprised at how well remote working is working out. So the productivity is great. The most important thing is that we are able to secure the safety and the health of all our, you know, stakeholders, our customers, our employees, our partners. And the work has not suffered. Now, if you ask me why, I think some of the investments that organizations world over, including TCS, made, whether it was in terms of embracing agile ways of working, whether it was in terms of setting up a digital workplace using collaboration tools like Teams or Slack or WebEx, Zoom, Skype, you name it. I think those things enabled the move to work without the business, you know, missing a heartbeat or dropping a ball. I think those were critical. And last but not the least, as that happened, I think the employers world over responded with a sense of, if I may use the word, empathy, because there was this recognition that while people are working from home, there is the need to support them with an operating model that, you know, builds that team culture, that team bonding, because people were stressed out, they were anxious. And I think whether it was doing Friday hangouts, coffee sessions, virtual pizza parties, yoga sessions, advice on health, nutrition, I think companies all over, including TCS, responded beautifully in supporting employees or associates and in recognizing that, you know, people need support. You know, like we've all become manager of one. Right. I have not, you know, gone to my office in the last several months. But, you know, the way the lines of work and personal life blur, it can leave people overwhelmed. And so how do you help them navigate through it? And sometimes people even suffer from guilt. You know, am I working enough? Is my work visible enough? Will I be promoted? So I think these things made the difference. You know, if this pandemic happened 15 years back, I do not know if we would have been able to transition as we did to remote working right now.
Right. Well, I do want to bring my co-host back in really quick, because sure. I think Brian is chomping at the bit here in behind the scenes here. Brian, I know you wanted to ask a question or two.
Actually, you know, one of the big buzzwords that we got from your marketing people is secure borderless workspaces. So my original question was, oh, this sounds like manager desktops or VDI. And just from the title. And it's like, I started reading a little further down and it's not. Could you talk about some of the tools and technologies that you folks use for your secure borderless workspace solution?
Yeah, so I'm going to talk about things at a few different levels. So first and foremost is that the secure borderless workspace operating model comes with a definition of distributed working models. It recognizes that teams are distributed by time zones and by locations, because even I'm based out of Chicago. So even if my team is based here in Chicago, we are all working out of our home offices. So we are still distributed by location. So how do you make work visible? And how do you build the cadence and the rhythm for the teams to work together and stay in sync as the work evolves was very critical. And that was defined by, and I apologize for using another TCS terminology here, but it's called location-independent agile. So how do you work in a distributed manner well? So I think the definition of those working models, supporting teams to embrace them, made a ton of difference in the overall productivity and efficiency. I'll give you a very simple example because Scrum is pretty popular in the industry today. So when you think of a daily stand-up, normally pre-COVID, we would do a stand-up once a day. And the idea was to, you know, look at the impediments and the blockers and get them out of the way and support the team. But then as we dealt with COVID and the pandemic, we found that it made sense to do two stand-ups, 4 hours apart. It kept the teams synchronized well. And most importantly, they were also used for team bonding, because if you're going to office, you're meeting people, you're working together, but now you aren't. And so these were some simple, I would say, ways of working that supported the transition. So that's at the process level, if you will. And then I talked a little bit about the one-team culture. We recognize that that would be very critical for long-term sustainability of this model and ensuring that people don't get burnt out. Because initially, let's face it, you know, people were working on a rush of adrenaline. And then you have to ensure that, you know, longer term, the model will be sustainable. So I think that's the where the culture, the support from our human resource business partners came in. We reached out to people proactively, checking in how people were doing. All that has made a difference in sustaining employee engagement levels. And the third bit is, you know, when you talk about, you know, the secure piece. So we have made sure that the security protocols are such that we protect our customers and ourselves from any kind of threat. So we have made additional investments on our security infrastructure, and then the enablement of digital collaboration tools. That's the last piece which makes this model work now.
Fantastic. When we come back, we have a lot more to talk about here, so definitely don't move. But before we get to all that great other content, we do want to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Worldwide Technology. Now, Worldwide Technology began building their advanced technology center, their ATC, 10 years ago, and it's grown exponentially. It's like no other testing and research lab anywhere. And the lab contains more than $500 million in equipment from hundreds of OEMs and key partners, ranging from heavyweights like NetApp and Cisco to emerging disruptors like Equinix. Now, WWT is a trusted partner who stays with you over the years. Many of their customers have been with them for over a decade because they know WWT is where they can go to get the answers they need to make sure their business runs right. Now, their ATC is an incubator, of course. At the very least, it's an incubator for an IT innovation and offers. It has on-demand and schedulable labs like NetApp Cloud Volumes ONTAP, NetApp Storage Grid, NetApp Disaster Recovery as a Service, along with hundreds of other labs representing newest advances in flash storage, multi-cloud, hyper-converged infrastructure, cloud data management, and a lot more. There's a lot more there. Now learn about products before you launch, because WWT's engineers use these environments to quickly spin up proof of concepts and pilots using the sandbox, so customers can confidently select the best solutions. In many cases, this reduces concept time from months to weeks with increased speed to market. Now, the lab offers a lab as a service. Now, it's a dedicated lab space within the ATC. Now, here customers can actually perform programmatic testing using the vast technology ecosystem the WWT has built. And it's virtual. So you can take full advantage of the ATC unique benefits anywhere in the world 24/7. And WWT engineers work in these labs every day, beta testing new equipment and building reference architectures and custom integrations to help their customers make decisions and see results faster with much less investment. Now, with WWT has launched their new digital platform encompassing the ATC ecosystem. Now, this ecosystem creates a multiplier effect of knowledge, speed, and agility anytime, anywhere around the world for all of their customers. Get access to articles, case studies, hands-on labs, and other tools that make the difference in today's fast-paced world. To learn more and discover why organizations across industries turn to WWT to guide them on their digital transformation journey, visit WWT.com/twit. And don't forget to create a My WWT account to access resources available through their WWT's Advanced Technology Center ecosystem. That's WWT.com/twit. WWT, delivering business and technology outcomes around the world. And we thank WWT for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we've been talking with Niti Srivastava about digital transformation, remote workforce, all of this great stuff that people having to deal with, organizations have been having to deal with over the last many, many years. And Cheebert, I want to go back to you because I know you had a couple other questions you wanted to ask before we went to Ed.
It's basically, we start getting down to how are you doing this? What is the process? How does a corporation that wants to try and get into this type of pivot, where did they start? How do they start? Who would they contact at TCS?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'll start with the easy one. Whom should they contact at TCS? So there's my colleague, very, very fine gentleman, Ashok Krish. And I would say any, you can reach out to our website. You can reach out to any partner of ours because we are present in all the states, a very, very strong global presence. So I would say just reach out to our website, put in an inquiry, and we will be there to support you. Coming to your question, how do you start the process? So what we offer is an assessment. So we come in and look at your security. We do a risk assessment. We did that for one of our Dutch insurer clients. We did that for one of our North America clients here, Manpower Solutions Group. So we come in, we would do the assessment, then we would build the roadmap. And then, you know, the roadmap is not a longish roadmap. It is something that gets executed in sprints and enable the infrastructure layer, the digital workplace, and also make the recommendations on what kind of processes, particularly, you know, the whether it's the agile ways of working or the people engagement processes that are critical. So these are the fundamental elements or dimensions of the SPWS operating model that we bring to our clients.
Well, I do want to bring Kurt back in because I think he has some questions as well. Kurt?
I appreciate that. It's been very interesting hearing you talk about your engagements. And one of the questions that I have is that typically when you are brought in to an engagement, are you typically brought in for one department, one operating group that might then spread to the rest of the company? Or do organizations tend to come to you and say, our entire organization needs to be agile, make it happen?
Both. It depends, you know, if the organization or the client has a very strong enterprise mindset. And sometimes people like to pilot things, particularly when it comes to agile. I have seen a strong executive tends to drive it across the organization. And this comes if they've had an experience of doing it someplace else and they're absolutely convinced about it. So then they invest the change management that it takes to get the entire organization to buy into it. The other approach is when you take one line of business, one tower, you do a pilot, prove it, and then you scale it. So I think we've seen both approaches.
Well, with both approaches going in your experience, does an entire organization need to be agile in order for any one piece of the organization to gain the most advantage from being agile? You know, I talked to chief executives who say that they really didn't understand what being agile meant until the entire organization had gone agile. Is that your experience?
Yes, indeed. You could argue that I'm a little biased given my role, but the reason, you know, here is my business case for agility across business and IT, across functional departments, because when you get the whole organization to sprint faster with fast feedback loops, you build a certain level of dissonance in the organization if people are sprinting at different intervals. So what I mean over here is that if a part of the enterprise takes a quarter to make a decision, whereas another part of an organization is ready with a decision, an action, a go, no go in 2 weeks, then they're waiting on the other organization because they have longer release times. So the other reason is that agility, as much as it is, like now it has taken the shape of a way of working, avatar, if you will, but it's also something that goes with your mindset. So it is about empowering people. It is about letting the people who do the work make the decisions. So if you have a lot of traditional waterfallish big batch thinking in the organization, in different parts, so you know, then you have a little bit of collision of your value system, your beliefs, the way you make decisions. That is the reason why going agile across the enterprise makes sense.
Andy, thank you so much for being here. We're running a little bit low in time. I do want to give you a chance to tell the folks at home one more time where their organization can go to maybe learn a little bit more about Tata, TSCCS, and maybe some of their latest offerings.
Sure. So TCS is one of the leading IT consulting, digital, and business transformation companies. We work with our clients to help them reimagine their digital journeys and drive growth and transformation. Our key offerings are in the space of consulting, services and integration, artificial intelligence, automation, IoT, TCS Interactive Services, and most importantly, the digital workplace that I just spoke about, that's where the SPWS operating model comes from. And we provide infrastructure services, business process services. So we pretty much are a soup to nuts shop as far as it comes to IT transformation and consulting.
Fantastic. Thanks again. Well, folks, you've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the Best Thing Enterprise podcast in the universe. So definitely tune your device to Twyatt. But I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host, starting with our geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, where can the people find you and what you're doing this coming week?
On Twitter is probably a good one. I'm ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab, and that's on Twitter. I'd love to hear from you. You're also more than welcome to throw me some email. I am Chibert@twit.tv. That's Chibert spelled C-H-E-E-B-E-R-T. My students had a Dilbert naming theme, and they insisted I had to be Chibert. But you know what? Why don't you send an email to twyatt@twit.tv, and that'll hit all the hosts. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear suggestions for shows. This is one of the reasons why we keep asking that origin story question, because we had a bunch of people trying to get started in industry, and they're saying, where do I go? And we said, you know, let's go and integrate the origin stories into the show and try and appeal to those getting started and as well as those that have been in the industry for a while. Love to hear from you. Thanks for watching.
Thank you, Chibert. Well, I want to thank my next co-host as well, and he's been busy at Black Hat and soon at DEF CON. Curtis, I've been following a lot of your Black Hat content. Where can the people go and find you, your work, and maybe even some of the DEF CON stuff that's coming up?
Well, you can find me, my work, all of my writing is going to be over at Dark Reading, darkreading.com, and especially at the edge of Dark Reading. It's a nice little blue box right there at the top. I've been at Black Hat the last couple of days, and for the next couple of days, you can find me around DEF CON. I'm going to be hanging out at several of the villages, so follow me on Twitter at KG4GWA. I'll be tweeting about the stuff that's going on there, and if you have something that you'd like me to see, be sure and hit me up with a direct message there. I'll be looking, and I always appreciate hearing from members of the Twiet Riot.
Thank you, Curtis. Definitely love doing this show with you guys. Well, folks, I also want to thank you as well. You're that person who drops in each and every week to watch and to listen to our show to get your enterprise goodness. And we want to make it easy for you to watch and listen to catch your enterprise news for the week. Go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twiet. There you'll find all of our amazing back episodes, the show notes, the co-host information, as well as especially the guest information, and of course the links of the stories we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos, you'll get those helpful download and subscribe links. That's right. Support the show by getting your audio version, your video version of your choice, and listen on any one of your devices or any one of your podcast applications, because we're on all of them. So definitely check it out and subscribe. That's really the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends with a gift of Twiet, because you know what? Your family members, your coworkers, they need to know about enterprise and IT news too. So you might as well share the gift of Twiet now. Now, after you subscribe and you maybe are available 1:30 p.m. Pacific time on Fridays, we do this show live. You can see, come see how the pizza's made, come see behind the scenes at live.twit.tv. Come check it out and see all the fun. Plus, we also have a great chat room. So if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well jump into the chat room as well, irc.twit.tv. There we have some great characters. They ask some great questions and have some great conversations about the show content. So definitely join them if you're going to watch the show live at irc.twit.tv. Of course, if you can't be watch the show live and you know you're subscribed, but you still want to be part of the conversation, we have a 24/7 discussion and conversation out there already at twit.community. It's the really great community website where all the hosts, sometimes the co-hosts, sometimes the guests, a lot of the communities out there, the Twit Army, lots of great conversations, lots of conversations about just about anything, especially tech. So go out there and check it out and be part of the discussion 24/7. Remember, you can always follow me, twitter.com/LouMM. There I post all my latest and greatest ways to actually make Office better for you, more productive for you, plus all my enterprise tidbits and all my fun stuff that I'm doing during the week, especially the Twit After Hours is coming up, the cookathon, the cooking show. We're looking forward to that. Of course, I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support us each and every week. We couldn't do this with enterprise tech without them, so thank you to all their support. Of course, we have to thank all the staff and the engineers at Twit. And of course, I also want to thank Mr. Brian Chee one more time. Chiebert, he is not only our co-host, but he's our tireless producer. He does all the bookings for the show, all the plannings for the show, and we really couldn't do the show without them. So thank you so much, Chiebert, for all your support and your continual support. Of course, before we sign out, we have to thank not only our editor, Victor, behind the scenes. He's lurking in behind the scenes here, but of course, Jeff as well. He's our engineer for today, and our TD for today. Jeff, thank you so much for being here. You know, you got a quite of a busy job. There's quite a bit of shows today, including the after hours. Is everything all set, ready to go?
Everything is set, as far as I know. We're just waiting for the Italian chef to show up. Wait a minute, that's you. So that's right, going to be great, right? Coming up in a bit.
Louis Kitchen's coming up. That's right. Looking forward to it.
Awesome.
Thanks a lot, Jeff.
You got it.
Well, take care, everybody. And just remember, until next time, I'm Louis Maresca. Just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twiet.
I'm Jason Howell, host of Hands on Android, where each week I take a look at the Android operating system and really dive deep into what it can do for you and how it can improve your quality of life, whether it be tips and tricks on how to use it better, whether it can be little known secrets that open up a world of possibilities. So many topics to dive into, including your emails. Subscribe by going to twit.tv/HOA. We'll see you there.